Morning, saints.
Good to see you. Morning, good
to see you. Rightio, we're going to carry on with Elijah. So if you've got a Bible, turn to 1 Kings chapter 19 and we'll carry on from where we left off last time. 1 Kings chapter 19. It's not working. Rightio. 1 Kings 19. Last time we looked at Elijah's great victory on Mount Carmel, how he took on the false prophets of Baal. Yeah, and this time we've got quite a change because you've got a massive victory to massive defeat. And I'm glad the Bible is the way it is because it always portrays all of the saints, warts and all. And with Elijah, you've got that in his life. How can someone have such an incredible victory as he did on Mount Carmel, only to be defeated by fear and anxiousness and panic and all of these things in the next breath? So we'll have a little look at some of this. So in chapter, we got up to last time, we looked at how he defeated the false priests, and God actually came through for Elijah, and he presented himself to the people that he was their true God. It wasn't Baal, but it was Jehovah. He was the one who was in charge of the weather, and he brought down fire, and then the rain came. And we looked at how Elijah ran before Ahab's chariot. And in reading some of that, I didn't really know what a lot of that was about. Why would he do that? One perspective that I had read is that the king always used to have a runner to go before his chariot. And this person's perspective was that Elijah had the mindset that God had now showed up. And he ran before the chariot because it was out of respect for the king. Like Elijah, even though Ahab, the way he was, he was still a wicked king. But Elijah had respect for that position. And he actually ran before Ahab back to Jezreel. And it says that he stopped at the entrance of Jezreel. So when you get to chapter 19, it says, "And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, 'So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time.' And when he saw that, he arose and he ran for his life and he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there." So the scene is you've got Ahab, he runs ahead, the Spirit of God comes upon him, and it's about a 20-mile run. So he runs ahead of the chariot all the way, but he stops at the entrance to Jezreel. And Ahab goes in. And I don't know whether Elijah had expected Ahab to be different, because he's just witnessed that, yeah, Baal is not the true God, Jehovah is. And Ahab, I don't know whether Elijah expected Ahab to actually work on his behalf or to say, "Look, Jezebel, the people have now turned back. Things have got a change in the land." But Ahab is unchanged. And Jezebel, with all this big contest that was going on Mount Carmel, she's left at home. And she would have been wondering how this big showdown was actually going. How was it panning out? And she would have seen the rain come down, and she would have probably thought, yes, Baal has come through, because he was the god of thunder. And but instead, Ahab comes in, and it says in verse 1 that Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. and also how he had executed the prophets. So he relayed to her everything that happened, the great challenge on Mount Carmel, and how that the false priests cried from the morning right till the time of the sacrifice in the afternoon, and nothing happened. There was just complete silence. They cut themselves and there was blood flowing and still nothing happened. But how Elijah prayed one simple prayer and the fire fell. So she would have been incredibly incensed at this. And I think, especially with the prophets being slain. So verse 2, then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." She was not going to lie down. And I think possibly Elijah underestimated her. But this woman was like a caged tiger. She came out fighting. And she sent a message, or really a threat. She really had it within her power to take his life there and then. But she didn't actually do that. She actually didn't go herself. She just sent a messenger with a threat. And she actually gave him one day's notice. Now, I don't know about you, but if you were going to take someone's life, you probably wouldn't give them a day's notice or the chance to do something about it. But
the tent
builds, doesn't it? So what was her intent? You know what I mean? Her intent, I believe, was to actually drive fear into the heart of Elijah. And it worked, you know. She actually had within her power the means to do it there and then with the people back in Jezreel. But she didn't. She gave him a day's notice. And when you get to verse 3, you really get to the crux of it all. And when he saw that, he arose and he ran for his life and he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. When he saw that, what was the that, do you think?
A message.
Yeah. See, I believe that Elijah, in his heart, believed that things were going to be different. Things were going to be different back at the palace. And when he saw Jezebel's response, it's a negative response. And I believe he either thought Ahab was going to stand up and be a righteous king because of God had come through, but he didn't. See, the battle in Elijah's mind was already over. God had presented himself to the people. They were no longer divided between two opinions. Their hearts were coming back to him. The priests had been executed. God had showed up, but yet there was this one woman who refused to actually lie down. And when he saw that, everything is about what we see. And he saw a negative response when he perceived that things should have been differently. But I think for us, like this passage says that you can be in victory one moment and defeat the next. And it's the same for Elijah, and it's actually the same for us. There's no difference. This is what I love about the Bible. James says that he was a man just like us, with same weaknesses and same strengths and things like that. And we are all the same. We can be on the mountaintop one day and running for your life the next. And it can happen so quickly. And for Elijah, the first thing was when he saw that. It was things and circumstances that he saw that he wasn't ready for. He thought that they were going to be different, but they weren't. When you think about it in everything is what we look at and how we view that circumstance. Look through the Bible, you've got a good example is Peter. You know, he had enough faith to actually get out of the boat, you know, and walk on the water. Amazing that he would actually be able to look at Christ and say, "Can I actually come to you?" You know, and to actually get out of the boat and actually put his feet on the water and walk on water. But what does the Bible say? It says when he saw the wind, when he saw the waves, when he saw circumstances, then instantly his gaze was taken off Christ and onto those things, and he began to sink. Just like with Elijah, it's the very same thing. When he was on Mount Carmel, God had to come through. He's looking, his gaze is upon God to be the victory. But here, in this instance, his gaze and his simple faith, his simple trust seem to be gone out the window. And all he can see is a woman's threat and her intentions. And things that he thought had been changed weren't. So he changes. The other one I was thought of was the spies. You know how the spies, 10, the was it 12 spies or 10? I can't remember. They went into the land. And two of them, they said, yeah, God is able to bring us through. But 10 of them, what did the 10 see? They said, yeah, this land is great. But they've got really fortified cities. You got a negative response. And not only that, you've got the descendants of Anak there, which are the giants. So again, what dominated their minds were the hindrances. And they overruled, so they took it. So the first thing with Elijah, it's really what you look at and how you respond to those things which you look at. And when he saw that, he arose and he ran for his life. He bolted. He was dominated by panic and by fear, and he ran for his life. And these things are the opposite to faith. And when these things dominate us, you're controlled by those things. And has anyone here had to run for their life? Has anyone ever been threatened? Not even back at school when someone says, I'm going to get you tomorrow. Judy, what was your instance?
Yeah, I had to run through the bush, seriously, for a boy because I'd been biting home for 3 years. And I had to run through the bush seriously.
And you obviously got away.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, scary time. Yeah. I remember I was... I used to play soccer for the Bay, and we got billeted out and went to Blenheim, and I was, I think, 11 or 12. And the first day I got billeted out, my billet took me for a walk to show me the environment, and we walked through the school, and some kid came up and we ended up getting into a fight, you know, and with well, it's not as you do when you're one day in a strange town. As you do in Blenheim, yeah. But we got into a fight, and this kid ended up going off home, and my billet and myself carried on walking through the school. And we got to across the road in the golf course, and we looked around, and he had gone home and got his older brothers. And they were about, I was about 12, and they were about 17 and 19. And my billet said to me, you better run. And so I ran, and I was running across this golf course, and these guys were chasing hard out after me. And I can still remember the adrenaline that actually kicks in when you're chased. And I ran right across, left my billet for dead, and ran right across the golf course. But they left my billet alone; they were after me. And they were like about maybe 200 metres behind me the whole way across the golf course. I'd never been there before. Ran out over the golf course, down the street, and down streets I never knew. Came around the corner and there was a shop, and I just ran straight into this dairy and dove over the counter. I was so pumped up on adrenaline. Dove over the counter and lay on the ground underneath the till. And the shopkeeper came out and he saw me on the ground and he just took one look at my face and said, oh, you know, I didn't say a word. And he walked out to outside a shop, and these boys came running along, and he said, you know, have you seen a young kid? And he went, yep. He went up that way. So they just went. And I didn't know a phone number to ring, I didn't even know where I was. And so I came out of the shop, and I went the other way. And my billet had then... He'd gone home and got his parents, and they were driving around looking for me, and they found me probably half an hour later wandering around down the streets. But that was scary. Literally. But Elijah, back to Elijah. He's filled with panic and fear, and he's running. He's running for his life. He actually runs about 80 miles. Doesn't say how long it takes him, but that's about the distance that he goes from Jezreel down to Beersheba in Judah. So he's going south. And yeah, it's a long way. But fear is an interesting thing. A couple of quotes that I read that I thought are really good. Fear is the little dark room where negatives are developed. I thought that is so true. When you think about things like, and fear is the little dark room where negatives are developed. And when you're like, Elijah's running for his life here, but there's lots of things that we're afraid about. And if you think everyone's afraid of different things, you know, there's lots and lots of little things that you shouldn't be afraid of, but you actually are, you know. And fear is that little room where all you see really is the negatives, and they seem to dominate, unfortunately. The other one was, to him that is dominated by fear, everything rustles. And it, you know, it's just so true. When you're in it, or when you're afraid, when you're bowing out of circumstances, everything is, seems to be heightened and be a problem. You know? Yeah, but it's in our DNA. It is. The first instance, when Adam and Eve fell, what was their first response? Yeah, they fled from God because they were afraid. And he called to them, "Where are you?" And they said, "Well, we're afraid because we're naked. Who told you you're naked?" But their first response, part of being fallen and sinful, is that we have these things in our DNA. We have fears and insecurities and worries and anxious things that, if they dominate us, cause us to have a fall, you know. Peter, you think about, just like Elijah, you can be on the mountaintop one day and defeated the next. Peter, he had enough boldness to actually stand off and cut off a guy's ear, you know, when he tried to arrest Jesus, only to be absolutely quietened by a little girl saying, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" in the very next instance, you know, from having a boldness to being afraid, just like that, you know. Do you guys remember the story of Robinson Crusoe? Good story. You know, he's a rat bag, but he gets shipwrecked, and he's got a Bible that gets washed up as a part of the wreckage, and he reads the Bible and has a relationship with the Lord on this island, a real good, steady, quiet relationship with God. And yet one day he sees a footprint in the sand. One footprint. And he knows that he's not alone. And he goes back to his camp and he boards it all up and he barricades it and he can't sleep anymore because he's worried about cannibalistic people and all these sort types of things. You know, just again, look what you see. He saw one footprint and it changed everything for him. He failed to trust in God because he was worried or fearful of that he wasn't alone. I read fears, apparently 40% of the things that we really fear never actually happen. 30% are in the past, so you actually shouldn't really even consider them. 12% are actually other people's business. Ten percent is sickness, things that we're afraid of. And which leaves 8% of things that are actually likely to happen, that you actually will have to face. So yeah, fear is an interesting one. I asked Blaze about fear because I was thinking, like we all suffer fears, you know. And I was just thinking about the military, and I was thinking, I said to Blaze, do they do stuff in the military to help you with fear? And he said to me, no, they don't. What they do is you practice and practice and practice and practice those things so that when the event occurs, it's just second nature to you. You just do it. You're not afraid. They just do it and do it and do it so that if when you come into that situation, your brain just kicks over. It's not dominated by fear. And then he said quite an interesting thing to me. He said, fear is actually not a negative thing. And he said, it can actually heighten your senses. And I thought, that's actually a really good point. Because it can, you know, like when you can be afraid, it can heighten those things, heighten awareness, heighten those things that you need. And that's good, actually. But when fear dominates, that's when it's not good. You know, when it dominates your thinking so that it actually rules over the way that you should actually act, that's when it's a problem. But fear in and of itself, I could see what he was saying, that it's actually got a purpose. It can heighten your senses, you know. So I thought, yeah, that's pretty good. But back to Elijah, he's full of it here. He's full of panic and he's full of fear and he's running for his life. Where on earth has the last 3.5 years of his faith gone? It's gone right out the window. And that's what fear and panic and anxiousness does. Faith just cannot be found. You see him at the brook, fully trusting God. You see him with the widow of Zarephath, fully trusting God. You see him on Mount Carmel, and God is active in all of those things. But in this instance, he's fallen, you know. Even Proverbs says, a righteous man can fall 7 times, yet rise again. So it's possible to have a perfect crash, but rise again. And Elijah's having a perfect crash right here. So, yeah, where's his faith gone? It's just gone out the window. So he runs 84 miles, and you get to verse 4. But he himself went a day's journey. So he left his servant after 84 miles journey, and he went on his own, and he came and sat down under a broom tree. And he prayed that he might die, and he said, it is enough now, Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's. So where does panic and fear lead to? He's depressed. He's in despair. He's depressed. He's distressed. But all of these things lead to this place. He sat down under a broom tree. And when I read that, I thought, he's asking to be swept away. Yeah, I know, a bit lame. Ellen will use that one. Yeah, that is a good one. Yeah. But should Christians get depressed? And the answer is no, they shouldn't, but yes, they do. You know? I mean, we've got everything available to us in Christ, but when we're not acting out of faith and if we're dominated by those insecurities and those fears, then it can lead to depression. And you see here Elijah, he's in that state now. Granted, there's one thing, it doesn't really talk about him. I think he physically is worn down here as well. He runs 20 miles, like he doesn't seem to stop. He has this confrontation with the prophets on Mount Carmel, and then he runs 20 miles, gets a message from Jezebel, and he runs another 80. So you've got to wonder whether, like, physical, we need to take care of our bodies, you know, because that actually has a part to play in our whole makeup. And I think Elijah is actually worn out and worn down, and everything has reached a crisis point for him. And he says, what's that?
You just said he only ate bread for 3.5 years.
Oh, he had meat as well because the ravens brought him meat.
Did he have any veggies?
No veggies. That's right. Yeah.
Sorry.
But he says, it's enough. Like, he's had it. Yes, Chris.
Like, it's interesting here where it says, he says, the Lord, take my life. He doesn't say, I'll take my own life.
Yeah, that's right. If he wanted to take his own life, he would have stayed with...
His life is still in the Lord's hands, as opposed to the despair of man, which is like, it's quite a quite a key thing to say, quite a good thing, isn't it?
Mm.
And he's still in God's hands, you know, you do what people like, but
I won't take my own life.
I won't do anything myself that will harm me. You do it.
That's good. Yeah, so he's consumed by his own failure, and he's really quite depressed, and he's saying, beam me up. I want out of here. I've had enough. I can't take any more. Is there any, in the Bible, when you look at the Bible, have other saints voiced the same thing? Is he alone in this? Who can you think of? Yeah, that's right. Jeremiah did. He cursed the day that he was born and said, why wasn't I killed at birth? You know? He was hated by everyone except God. He had depression. You could say Jeremiah was very depressed at times, but he was still faithful to God. Moses was one in Numbers 11. Numbers 11, 10 to 15, he's burdened with the complaints of the people. And he says, God, I just can't carry on. You kill me now or do something. I can't take any more of this. Kill me now. Moses actually says to God. And the other one that I thought of was Jonah. And I think we'll have a quick squiz at Jonah because it's actually quite a little bit similar to this passage. If we can find the book. I had Jonah just before Micah. Jonah chapter 4. Jonah chapter 4. But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. This is because the people of Nineveh had actually repented. So he prayed to the Lord and said, Our Lord, was not this what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Now therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. And then the Lord said, Is it right for you to be angry? So Jonah went out of the city and sat on the east side of the city, and there he made himself a shelter, and he sat under it in the shade till he might see what would become of the city. And the Lord God prepared a plant, and it made it come up over Jonah, that it might be shade for his head to deliver him from his misery. So Jonah was very grateful for the plant. But as morning dawned the next day, God prepared a worm, and it so damaged the plant that it withered. And it happened when the sun arose and God prepared the vehement east wind, and the sun beat on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. Then he wished death for himself and said, It is better for me to die than to live. Then God said to Jonah, Is it right for you to be angry about the plant? And he said, It is right for me to be angry even to death. Oh, Jonah's got it real bad. But at least he's honest with God, you know. But here you've got the same thing. You've got, he's bitter and he's angry and he's really slacked off with God. And he's saying, look, I just want out. I've had enough. I don't want any more. And God is really gracious to Jonah with the plant. And in the same way, God is really gracious to Elijah. Despite all his weaknesses, when you turn back to this passage, you see the next part that he's actually cared for by an angel, which we'll probably get to next time. But I think one of the biggest problems for Elijah is in the end of this chapter 4, he says, It's enough now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my fathers. Whoever said he was. Whoever, you know? And I think possibly Elijah might have got himself a little bit puffed up on Mount Carmel. And I think he's possibly a little bit overinflated. And all the way through, you see this consistent with Elijah, that he considers himself that he's the only one that God's got. And it happens more than once all the way over. I'm the only one that's left. But he wasn't. And I think possibly Elijah sees himself as a little bit indispensable to God. And one great saint on his deathbed, I can't remember the guy's name, but he said to another brother this quote, and it's actually a really good quote. He says, "Few men are important, none are necessary." And that's actually very true. You know, no one is indispensable to God. And Elijah's thing here, look, I'm no better than my fathers. Did he consider himself to be better? Part of his depression, really, is that he's just consumed by his own failure. And that the nation actually, or Jezebel, had really threatened him. She hadn't changed. He failed, really, in the things that he was strong at. When you look at Moses, was the meekest man on the earth, yet he spoke harsh and bitter words. You know? Sometimes your strengths is where you'll fail. Abraham was a man of massive faith, yet his faith failed him many times when he was down in Egypt and places like that. Same with Elijah. He was a courageous man. There's none more courageous to take on a whole nation and to take on false prophets, but yet he fled from the voice of one angry woman. The very things that he was courageous about, he actually fled. So when I look at this passage, it's a perfect fall, you know, from victory to defeat. And most of it really has got to do with what he saw and how he perceived that. And then those things just took over. Panic came in. Faith went out the window. He was fearful, and it actually led to him being depressed. And God is incredibly gracious when we're actually like that. Because you see, when it goes on, the next time we'll look at this, that God doesn't say, "Oh, well, you're out of here," you know. He changes his office, but he's really gracious and he provides what he needs. He needs the food. His journey in God is not over. One other thought I had, which as a child of God, our sins are always forgiven. And you see this with Elijah, that even though he's had a perfect crash and failures come into his life, God still restores him. But as a servant of God, things change for him. He's not reinstated back into the position that he had. And I thought that's actually quite an interesting point. Because as a child, we are always forgiven. But there's things that we can do with our calling that God will just, yeah, you're forgiven, but you might not be reinstated with that calling that God has got for you. He'll just use someone else. And as we follow the story on, he actually uses Elisha to take Elijah's place. After, that'll probably be another couple of messages, but God is still incredibly gracious, and he provides for him for what he needs. And as you follow the story through, he's actually trying to get out of Elijah. He just says to him, "What are you doing here?" He's after the honesty. And when you look at Elijah's responses, he still hasn't quite got it. But, yeah. Anyone else see any other stuff in that passage?